From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from Air America headquarters in New York. And on today's show, give me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. We're heading out to the ballpark to talk evangelicalism and professional sports.
Big-time sports has become one of the most conspicuously and outwardly religious sectors of our popular culture. And this is part of an intentional strategy to try to leverage the influence and popularity of sports to get out the evangelistic message.
Journalist Tom Krottenmaker joins me for a lively conversation about sports, God, and the growing religiosity of professional athletes. Plus, we'll hear about a landmark legal decision for members of the Sikh faith who want to serve in the armed forces. But first, voters went to the polls earlier this week to elect new governors in New Jersey and Virginia, a new congressman in New York, and to weigh in on the issue of marriage equality in Maine. We saw religious conservative Bob McDonald deliver a crushing blow to Democrat Creed Deeds with some help from robocalls by the famous Sarah Palin. And fellow culture warrior Maggie Gallagher, president of the National Organization of Marriage, made her presence known in the state of Maine, helping to overturn a bill passed just last May legalizing same-gender marriage. So, what do these victories say for the reach and the power of the religious right? Remember, that was an entity pronounced dead just a year ago with the election of Barack Obama. I'm joined now by journalist Sarah Posner, a frequent guest here on State of Belief. Sarah is an associate editor of the online magazine Religion Dispatches, where she covers politics. She has answers to all kinds of questions, and we're glad she's with us. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me again, Welton.
I never did buy this death knell thing for the religious right, and I know that you didn't either. In the big picture, how prominent was the religious right in this past week's elections?
Well, I think that everybody is going to look first at Maine, because obviously it was the religious right that got the repeal of Maine's gay marriage law on the ballot and got the votes out to actually get that law repealed. But I think that the real power of the religious right was better seen in the Virginia race for governor, not because Sarah Palin endorsed Bob McDonald, or even because the resurrected, shall we say, Ralph Reed also got voters out to go vote for him, but because McDonald is a graduate of Pat Robertson's Regent University, where he wrote a thesis in which he said that working women were detrimental to the family, came out strongly against homosexuality and birth control, even for married couples, and that was considered mainstream and normal enough for him to very easily be elected governor of Virginia, a state that went for Barack Obama just 1 year ago.
So does he owe his win to the religious right credentials he carries?
Well, I think that he carries those credentials enough so that he could get the religious right vote out for him if they were enthusiastic about him. But he also normalized it enough that he obviously got more moderate Republican votes, independent voters, and probably even some Democrats.
Now, we also saw a victory in New Jersey for anti-choice and anti-marriage equality gubernatorial candidate Chris Christie. But he also talked very little about social issues. He talked an awful lot about the economy.
Right.
So, I mean, I suppose some people would say, well, that wasn't a religious right victory. So how do you put those two together?
Well, I think it was a victory in the sense that the Family Research Council PAC had endorsed Christie in late October. So they viewed him as a candidate, not just as them wanting the Republican over the Democrat or the conservative over the liberal. They actually went as far as to endorse him. But like you said, those social issues were not a big top of the agenda in the New Jersey race. That's partially just because New Jersey isn't the kind of state that really responds to those kinds of issues. They're not normally big issues in statewide elections. But it's also because the economy is you know, people are really hurting, and they want to hear about economic issues. And I think that when they looked at Corzine, who's a former Goldman Sachs CEO, and people are still thinking about the TARP and the bonuses that the Goldman Sachs executives were getting, and I think that putting those things together, that all those social issues didn't matter as much.
I don't want to skip entirely the congressional election in New York's 23rd district.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was a district that had voted a Republican into Congress for something like 100 years. It's up in northern New York near the Canadian border. There was a Republican, Didi Scosafava, running, and she was pro-choice and pro-gay marriage, and she was the Republican. The Democrat was a fellow named Bill Owens, and then there's a third party in New York called the Conservative Party, and they ran a candidate named Doug Hoffman, who quickly became the darling of Sarah Palin and Tim Pawlenty and the Tea Partiers. And he surged so much in the polls right before Election Day that the Republican was forced to, she was coming in third in those polls behind him and the Democrat, and she eventually dropped out and endorsed the Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So it really highlighted that schism in the Republican Party between the more moderate folks, to the extent that they're left, and the religious right and Tea Party element that's really trying to take over the Republican Party. Now, the Democrat, Bill Owens, ended up winning, but, you know, Hoffman had a lot of disadvantages in that district. He was not from the district and knew very, very little about local issues, which I think was a real turnoff, even for Republicans in that district. So I don't know if it's a bellwether of how well a religious right-backed Republican or third-party candidate would do in other races in other districts, but I think it definitely was emblematic of how energized that part of the Republican base is, that they would go up to northern New York and spend all those resources and all that energy on that race.
Well, and that circles all the way back to how you opened in this interview with Maine and the repeal of the state's law on same-gender marriage, because you had a heavy involvement both by the Catholic Church and by some very religious right organizations there. Very quickly, before we go, what do you see as the larger implications here? Is the religious right saying to the Republican Party, we're still relevant and you better stay in this marriage with us?
I think most definitely, and I think they're most definitely making that alliance in particular with the Tea Party element of the party, but also with the party at large. And I think that the party is going to take the Bob McDonnell example to heart, I think, that they could run somebody like that that will energize the base without talking about it too much, and but emphasize to other voters those fiscal and economic issues.
Do you hear some echo from Ralph Reed saying something about stealth candidates?
perhaps.
Sarah Posner is an associate editor at the website Religion Dispatches, where she covers politics. She also writes for the American Prospect. The Nation, Salon, and The Washington Post. And we're always happy to have Sarah as a guest on State of Belief. Sarah, thanks again for being on State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. And if you're a sports fan like me, you probably noticed how common it is for athletes to wear their faith on their sleeve. Well, I actually guess I should say on their jersey. You see baseball players genuflecting in the batter's box and quarterbacks pointing to the heavens when they throw a touchdown. Well, up next, we're going to learn how these seemingly spontaneous religious gestures might not be so spontaneous after all. The role of Christian ministries in professional sports. That story's on deck. And we're coming right back after this short break. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Getty. It's now time to pick up your Cracker Jacks if you've got them handy, for those of you celebrating the World Series, that is, and gearing up for a basketball season or rooting for your favorite football team to secure a playoff spot. I wonder whether you have noticed, as I have, a particular trend in professional sports. Now, I'm not talking about the debates over an ever-rising salary cap or the growing accusations of steroid use. I'm talking about the abundance of God talk among professional athletes. You know, it's hard to watch a football game today without seeing a wide receiver pointing to the heavens after crossing the goal line or dropping down to a knee in the end zone after scoring a touchdown. And then there are the basketball teams that gather at midcourt for a moment of prayer rather than a jump ball. It would seem that personal displays of religion have become as common on the field as foul balls and team fight songs. And now I know this hasn't always been the case. And my next guest happens to agree. Tom Krattenmaker is a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors, and Tom writes for the paper's On Religion series. He's the author of the new book, Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. And in this book, Tom reveals a well-planned and well-funded network of evangelical religious conservatives who have slowly infiltrated the ranks of high school, college, and professional sports, hoping to use the reach of the sports world to advance their religious message. I recently spoke with Tom Krattenmaker, and I asked him to tell me about how groups like the Fellowship of Christian Athletes have contributed to the now ubiquitous presence of faith in sports.
What I think people don't fully realize is that this is partly a reflection of hard work that a set of evangelical Christian ministries have been doing now since World War II. And this is part of an intentional strategy to try to leverage the influence and popularity of sports to get out the evangelistic message. And so I guess we're seeing that when we're watching football on Sunday and we're seeing players point up to God after a touchdown, talking about Jesus in the post-game interviews.
You write extensively about an organization known as the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. It's a popular sports ministry that was started back in the 1950s. The FCA was started explicitly for what you just said, a means of marketing Christ through professional sports. So essentially, was their approach to make Jesus a product that sports stars could sell in the same way they sell Gatorade or Nikes or whatever?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. I think people at FCA might resist that characterization a little bit. But when I interviewed these guys, they're pretty frank about it. They talked about it being sort of a target marketing strategy. they'll acknowledge that athletes are used to endorse a whole variety of products. And so why not have them endorse something as good and true and powerful and wonderful as the Christian gospel? So that's sort of the method in a nutshell.
How have the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball owners and executives, how have they handled that? Are they comfortable with this marriage of religion and sports that's happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have found that the management of pro sports does not want to have this conversation. I tried all sorts of ways to get the brass at these top pro leagues to talk with me about religion and sports, and I've scanned the public record to see what they've said about it, and there's almost a complete silence, except for a few platitudes about how, well, we can't have guys imposing their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a few platitudes, there's been almost nothing on the record. Now, if you want to speculate about the bind they're in, you can really understand why they would be reluctant. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, they don't want to be perceived as, you know, silencing God or muzzling Jesus. That wouldn't be good for, you know, their product being popular among some segments of the population.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they know that this exclusive Christian doctrine that is stressed by these ministries has the potential to be divisive and to repel some segments of the fan base.
Mm-hmm. I want to be really careful the way I ask this next question, because
sure.
I don't have any competence, and I don't know anybody that does, to judge someone else's religion. But
yeah.
Talk for a minute about the level of sincerity and the depth of an understanding of religion or even evangelical Christianity among the athletes that are most known for this.
Well, Welton, I think it's going to vary some from athlete to athlete. In my research, I've encountered some Christian athletes who are quite sincere, and they have a pretty good and deep handle on what Christian faith is about. And they stay clear of any kind of scandal, and they behave in a generally principled way. Now, that said, you do come across a lot who are pretty superficial. They seem to have this idea that, you know, God is blessing them with touchdowns and home runs, and that is kind of the point of their Christian belief. And there are other guys who sort of like it for their image, but they don't follow through in their day-to-day life. One great case study would be Dwight Howard, who's the star center for the Orlando Magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the listeners might remember that when he came into the league a few years ago, he was talking about how his goal was to one day see the cross on the NBA logo. And since then, we've seen some things from him that don't exactly add up. For example, he does have a child out of wedlock. And just a couple weeks ago, he posed nude in this spread that ESPN, the magazine, had with superstar athletes.
And you see a discrepancy here?
maybe there's a discrepancy. Anyway, I will say that this does arouse the cynicism of many of the fans who aren't quite buying it.
I'm Welton Getty. I'm speaking with Tom Krattenmaker about his new book, Onward Christian Athletes. More of that conversation is coming up after this short break. Come right back with us. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. My guest today is Tom Krattenmaker. We're talking about Tom's new book, Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers, about the growing presence of faith in the sports world. I asked Tom to tell me about the role of sports chaplains and whether the growth in this position has had a positive or negative impact on the teams.
Well, when I talk to people about my research, I find out that they're usually surprised to learn that every one of the teams in Major League Baseball, football, and basketball has a chaplain embedded with it. And for the most part, these chaplains come from conservative Christian ministries and theological perspectives. There's pretty much two parts to their job. One part is to give moral guidance and support to athletes to sort of help bring religious resources to the athletes, which I can totally understand. The other part of it, though, is that they're consciously trying to use these athletes and the visibility of sports to get out the evangelistic message.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I remember for a long time watching in Major League Baseball players genuflect before they stepped into the batter's box. Now
sure.
Then, we have football players pointing to the heavens or dropping to a knee after a touchdown. I don't want you to judge that, but is that more just something you do, or do you think that's really a sincere acknowledgement of faith?
Well, I could see it both ways. I mean, I'm sure you would agree that gratitude is a natural form of religious expression.
Right.
When something really wonderful happens in the heat of the moment, it's natural to be grateful for that and to thank God or do some prayer gesture. On the other hand, I do know from doing the research for this book that a lot of the prayer and the religious gestures we see in sports are intended to be seen. Mm-hmm. There's a story I tell in the book about how the chaplain of the Philadelphia 76ers encouraged the guys on the team to start circling up at midcourt after the game to do a prayer. He was sort of borrowing the thing that we see in pro football. And he wanted the players to be seen praying that way because it was one way of witnessing.
Tom, let me ask you this. Does the dominance of Christian evangelicalism in the sports community create friction between teammates who are members of different faith traditions or maybe some who aren't religious at all and in the presence of those who claim religion as their driving force?
Yeah, I did come across numerous stories where the religious practice of some members of the team would cause some friction and some problems for the guys on the team who aren't religious. One example would be the San Antonio Spurs in the 90s when David Robinson and Avery Johnson and these guys were new and super enthusiastic in their faith. And then that team also had guys like Dennis Rodman and Jack Haley who were known as big party guys.
Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely friction between those two factions of the team. And you see some of that, too, around the Baltimore Ravens more recently. You know, their team leader is Ray Lewis, the superstar linebacker, who's super Christian. And it's kind of a dilemma for guys on the team who aren't so religious. I mean, they want to go along with the leader. They want to fit in. They want there to be team unity. But it can be uncomfortable to be around some of this overt conservative religious practice in the locker room if you don't believe that kind of teaching.
Did you see, by the way, does the conservative Christianity also have an associated conservative political point of view?
One thing I found in my research is that often there's a strong alignment between the Christianity we see in sports and Christian right political ideology and interests and people. I did some investigative journalism to see where these predominant sports ministries got their support and their money. And a lot of it is from Christian right organizations and people. You'll find that many of the leading Christian figures in sports are also involved with Christian conservative organizations mm-hmm. and far-right political interests.
Tom, I want to be perfectly fair here because I know that you think the presence of faith in sports is not all bad, and I agree with that.
Quite so.
Talk about some of the positive aspects you see.
Well, we all know that pro sports is this huge money-making enterprise. And there's violence, there's greed, there's a lot of self-aggrandizement. I really think that the ministries and the Christian athletes help bring some positive moral influence to the game, and I think that the sector really needs that. Many Christian athletes are very good citizens. They're involved in philanthropy. They manage not to get caught up in all of the egoism and the sexual promiscuity. So, yeah, there's no doubt that Christianity in sports does help bring that positive moral influence.
I don't know anything about you personally, but what did writing this book do to you?
Well, one thing I try to do as a writer is to always allow my own stereotypes to be challenged and changed. And there was a redemptive part of this experience I had writing the book, and people will see it in the closing chapter. I had a very deep and friendly engagement with Athletes in Action, one of the predominant conservative Christian ministries in sports. They were extremely hospitable to me. They invited me out to their headquarters, where I spent the better part of 2 days, got to interview a lot of them. One of the guys had me out to his house for dinner. And I was pleasantly surprised by how open these guys at Athletes in Action are to sort of a new form of sports ministry. They're really concerned about a lot of the immorality in sports. They were telling me things like how the old evangelism model is broken and it's time to reinvent this. They question the effectiveness and wisdom of athletes witnessing in the way that they do it. And I came out of that with really a friendly relationship with this organization and kind of an ongoing partnership.
So let me ask you one other question. Have you learned how to predict who's going to win the Super Bowl? Or
Yeah, you do. You find out which team has more Christian athletes. And then you put your money on that team, right? Just kidding.
Tom Krautenmaker is the author of Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. He's also a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors and writes for the newspaper's On Religion series. Tom, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. And there's a lot more to come today, including a look at how the Army could become a lot more welcoming to the members of a minority faith. This is a fascinating story. We've got it coming up after this short break. Stay tuned, please. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Recently, the armed forces took a major step forward in accommodating a member of a minority faith. Captain Kamal Singh Kelsey is a doctor and a member of the Sikh religion who was recruited into the Army's Health Profession Scholarship. Captain Kelsey wore his turban throughout his 8 years of military training, but upon completing the program and preparing to begin active duty, he was told he must cut his unshorn hair and remove his turban, both of which are religiously mandated by the Sikh tradition. With the help of the advocacy organization, the Sikh Coalition, Captain Kelsey appealed to Army authorities asking for a religious exemption to policy, and the Pentagon recently granted his request. He will now be able to serve his country while still adhering to the basic tenets of his faith. Captain Kamal Singh Kelsey joins me right now in studio, and also with us is Amar Singh, Program Director of the Sikh Coalition. Welcome, both of you, to State of Belief.
Thanks, Walter.
Thank you.
Captain Kelsey, I'm trying to imagine what it felt like to be put in a position of thinking that you were facing a problem that could cause you the dilemma of having to decide between the dictates of your religion, which you love, and your profession related to the American military. What did that feel like?
You know, it was very hard on many different levels, you know, personally, financially, spiritually. And it's something that, you know, the family and I, you know, all kind of experienced together. It's something that my wife and my kids, you know, this is part and parcel of something that they've gone through as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the follow-up is natural. What does it feel like to have that tension relieved and now know that it's possible?
I just don't have the words to describe it. I was ecstatic, you know, to be able to follow the footsteps of our strong military tradition. We have such a rich military history. in terms of Sikh service in both the U.S. Army as well as armies across the world. And certainly I'm fourth generation military within my own family. And then be able to do the job that I love and then at the same time have the respect of my community members, because this is an option that's not been available to us for the past 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've wanted dearly to be able to serve in the United States.
But did you think it would happen?
I was hopeful. You know, Amr actually and I grew up together here in Jersey. You know, we'd go to Yankee games, and so when I came to him late last year and said that the military is giving me a hard time about my turban and beard, I don't know what to do. He said, you know, I know what to do. That made a huge difference.
Sure.
in our life.
Amr, I know this is a victory for the Sikh Coalition that worked on this case. But at the same time, if I understand it correctly, the Army said this is an individual accommodation and not a change in policy. So what are the implications here for other Sikhs who want to serve in the armed forces?
Well, we're thrilled that Captain Khalsi was accommodated and he'll be able to serve his country and maintain his faith. But unfortunately, as you've identified, the next Sikh who says, I want to serve, is going to have to go through the same long accommodation process that Captain Khalsi's had to go through. So it's a victory for Captain Khalsi individually, but not for the Sikh community in general and of course, the values we uphold as Americans.
Yeah, and I want to elaborate that so that our listeners understand that the situation we're talking about goes way beyond the armed forces. Sikhs in many different professions face this problem, whether it's a Sikh musician at Disney World who was told that he couldn't wear a turban while performing, or the transit workers in New York who were forced to wear logos on their turbans. Could this individual decision made by the Army have ramifications throughout the Sikh community in the United States?
Yeah, you've identified the heart of the matter. Our organization, the Sikh Coalition, which works to create a space for Sikhs in the public square, has identified the Army as perhaps our number one target.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that the Army, being the most symbolic employer in the United States and the largest employer in the United States, if they would end discrimination and evaluate Sikhs simply on the basis of their ability to do their job and nothing else, we could end discrimination in the other spheres that you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. In a press release issued by the Sikh Coalition, Amr, you say that Sikhs' inclusion in the Army not only helps the military understand the many faiths and cultures of America, but also the faiths of cultures of other countries where we send soldiers into harm's way. Elaborate that just a little bit, because I think it's a terribly important point.
Well, think about it. Captain Khalsi comes from a military tradition that is very well known by locals in Afghanistan. He speaks a language that they can understand. In terms of trying to send a message to folks who were trying to work with in Afghanistan and democratize that country, having someone who looks like Kamal sends a message that America is the values it preaches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Captain Khalsi, tell me exactly, did you have now the ability to keep both the beard and the turban in your job?
That's correct. For my discussions with the military, they said that they would accommodate certainly my turban and beard and long unshorn hair, as long as it's neat and tidy. And, you know, the details of this we haven't discussed specifically. But, you know, Sikh officers that have served with the military in the past, namely Colonel Seiko, Colonel G.B. Singh, that just retired earlier this year, you know, wore their turbans, wore their beards, and served honorably.
I don't have to say to the two of you how important religious liberty is in this nation,
because this is the kind of decision that helps underscore the importance of that freedom. Is that widely understood in the Sikh tradition?
It certainly is, and actually the Sikh tradition is one that has fought for religious liberty throughout our history. Every Sikh child, when they're growing up, is told, and you'll see this in every Sikh household, the story of the ninth guru or master of our faith, who literally decided to give up his life as protest against the ill treatment of another faith community in India at the time he did so. The idea being that we have an obligation not only to fight for ourselves, but fight for everyone, and not just our own religious tradition, but everyone's religious tradition.
Unfortunately, in the United States, many people think that religious freedom means freedom for my religion, but not necessarily yours. Captain, I imagine that you will have opportunities to talk about the importance of religious freedom a good bit in the future.
Oh, yeah. I welcome it. You know, there's going to be a lot of discussion as to, you know, what my turban means and, you know, what that means in kind of a larger context. For me, this means that I have a 9-month-old. When he grows up, he can say, well, you know, I want to join the military too. And you know, his mom's going to say no, but but then he'll come to me and I'll say, well, okay. And hopefully he won't have to kind of jump through all the hoops and, you know, he won't have to lobby Congress. He won't have to write letters to the Secretary of Defense. He won't have to gather 15,000 signatures. It's been a very a long process, but we're so happy that that the Army has come to this decision.
Well, I appreciate the perspective that you all have about the importance of this freedom and the fact that you were willing to work for it, to see not only that you have it, but that other Americans have it as well. My guests are Captain Kamal Singh Khalsi and Amar Singh, Program Director of the Sikh Coalition. Thank you both for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, friends, are you out of breath? Well, I could understand it, but that's our show for this week. You want to get in touch with us? I hope so. Well, then write us. Go to stateofbelief.com, click on the Contact Us page, or remember, you can call us. Our phone number is 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking about. Tell us about the show and your thoughts about the show, or really anything else that's on your mind. We want to hear from you. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to get involved in the cause for religious liberty? This is a great way to do it. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. I'll be right back here next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics and the intersection of religion and some other areas of life as well. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit,
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.